Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is, this is Carrie L.'s Heartling Show. And I'm just waking up. It's early for me, so I'm just waking up, but we're going to have a great show today. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are going to create more freedom and light and love, one interview at a time. And my programs will bring you insights into the great awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. And I'll be interviewing cutting-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual. And stay tuned for the next hour when I speak to one of the most recognized, internationally recognized spokespersons on science of spirituality. That's Lynn McTaggart. I'm so excited that she's with us today. And so just stay tuned and know that you can call in at the bottom of the hour if you wish. We have 800 numbers there for you on the internet. And we'll be also enjoying an hour of interesting information about the intention experiment. So stay tuned. My information, first of all, I'd like you to know that you can go to heartlinkinstitute.com and find out more about what I do as a psychotherapist. And you can also find out about the crop circle cards. They're an oracle deck that I created, several years ago, and they involve, obviously, the crop circles. But it is one of the best decks using this information to access your higher self. So also, I'm all running different programs, and you can find out about them, blueprinting workshops and classes at the Heartlink Institute. And so I'd love for you to let me know what you think if you want to email me. And, of course, any questions for today's show, you can email me. And the email is right there on the Internet. So as we go now into the show, I want you to just take a deep breath and relax. And the blessing of the day comes from the Gayatri Prayer. Let us focus on that effulgent light from which the whole universe is projected. May this inner sun enlighten our minds and hearts, and may we awaken as that light. And now just allow the sacred love to flow through you now, allowing good things to come your way. And as I said, we have Lynn McTaggart today, and she is the author of 5 books, including The Intention Experiment and The Field, and is running worldwide Living the Field master classes and groups designed to help people adapt to the ideas of the new scientific paradigm into their everyday life. And as I said, she is the leading spokesperson right now in many ways, giving us a scientific approach to spirituality. She is the co-executive director of Conitas, which publishes the UK most well-respected health and spiritual newsletter and online information. And she wrote The Field, which is another bestseller, which offers some of the very latest scientific evidence about the power of your own thoughts, and mind-blowing new evidence now in The Intention Experiment about the nature of reality. And from the science Lynn also has extrapolated a detailed program to direct your thoughts, to increase the activity and strength of your intentions, and to affect genuine change in your life. And on my website, you can find her information as well, a link to her website, as well as on the BBS radio website, of course. If you want to scroll down to Wednesday's show information, this is Carrie L's Heart Link, and you will find that information. We are currently doing a live show at a very special time. But at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, you can find the show information. So I want to welcome Lynn McTaggart.
Hi there.
Well, that was kind of a long introduction, Lynn. I finally got it out. I must say, it is kind of early for me. I know it's late there. And are you in London? Is that where?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, yeah. So we are.
So it's late for us. It's end of my day.
But just the beginning here in Southern California. Well, how are you?
I'm very well, and it's nice to be chatting with you today.
Well, I'm excited because, you know, everyone is talking about the field and, of course, the quantum science behind all of that. Could you explain to us, first of all, what's the intention experiment? What's that about?
It is what grew out of my work in the field. I was very interested in the implications of a number of scientists who had been doing work in consciousness, and their work suggested that consciousness is an actual energy with the power to change matter and change the world. So being the kind of practical person that I am, I wanted to test this, and I wanted to research it. So I looked into all the science of intention, and I was particularly interested in the idea of lots of people getting together and sending an intention to change something all at the same time. And my husband, I wasn't getting very far looking at this, and so my husband came to me and said one night, well, why don't you do these experiments yourself? And I thought that sounded ridiculous because I'm not a scientist. I'm just a writer. I've written about science for many years, but I am not a scientist myself. But then as I started thinking of it, I thought, well, I've got loads and loads of readers around the world, and I know lots and lots of scientists. If I just put them together and I asked people to send an intention via my website to a number of scientists and their targets, we'd have the largest mind over matter experiment in history. So that's what we did.
Wow.
And that's what we're doing. I'm working with a variety of scientists around the world, and their work is really exciting. And we're coming up with incredible, incredible results. I mean, far beyond what we thought. And we are pushing the boat out with each experiment to see, you know, what more we can learn about the power of intention.
Well, you say that mind over matter works. That's fascinating, and of course, I work with people all the time in helping them to set intentions and so forth, and I do agree with that. Can you give us examples of what you mean by that?
What I mean about mind over matter working?
Yeah.
There are enormous number of studies that have been done in the laboratory of testing the power of consciousness to affect matter. And there have been tests on these things called random event generators, which are a kind of a 21st century toss of the coin. And they have a random activity that say is an image on a computer screen that flashes back and forth with images of apples and pears. And it goes back and forth and back and forth between the two. And what has been found over many, many studies, many thousands of studies, is that people can send an intention for more apples than pears, and they get them over these thousands of studies. So that's been the case. They've been able to demonstrate that you can send intention to affect these machines, And there have also been loads and loads of studies of using consciousness to affect everything from single-celled organisms to full-fledged human beings. There's at least 150 great studies of spiritual healing. And they demonstrate and have been put together as a review and looked over and found that there definitely is an effect. So we know consciousness can somehow affect matter. And it was my task, really, to look into it and figure out how can this be? What's the scientific mechanism behind it? And also, what can we do with it? You know, we know that this worked, so how far can we go with it? What can we do with it?
Well, you talked about how it works and that reality is not set in stone. And I find that fascinating. And you talk about the zero-point field. By the way, I did read your book, The Intention Experiment. And, oh, I mean, there's a plethora of information and studies, as you say. And but it's funny because you say that this book is without an ending, which I love that. And, of course, we are going to help participate, or people out there are going to participate in helping for the ending, using our own mind over matter. So as you describe this zero-point field, tell us about that and what that means and what non-locality means.
Okay. Well, the zero-point field has been known about since the discovery of quantum physics in the beginning of the 20th century. But we now understand that maybe it has much more import than those scientists realized back then. The zero-point field is caused by the little energy dance that goes on between subatomic particles. All subatomic particles send energy back and forth like a little game of basketball. And they send this ball back and forth. And in the process of sending energy back and forth, a third particle is created, a thing called a virtual particle, which stays there for the less than the blink of an eye. It's just a little flash of energy. So there's not very much energy in one exchange, but when you multiply that by all the subatomic particles doing these basketball passes in all the things in all the universe, you come up with this enormous, just unimaginable amount of energy sitting there in empty space. It's like a supercharged backdrop. Now, there are two huge implications with the zero-point field. One is, all of us, everything in the universe, is doing this subatomic dance. So we are all part of this. We are all part of this giant energy field. It all unites us. So we are, in a sense, in touch with the furthest reaches of the cosmos. And secondly, because it's made up of quantum energy waves, waves go on infinitely, hence attaching one side to the other side, in a sense. That's why we're in touch with the furthest reaches of the cosmos. But also, waves encode information. And when they bump into each other, they take on each other's information. So, in a sense, we have this enormous tape recorder, this enormous energy memory bank there. And with every day, it's getting that much smarter. So we have a vast store of the world's knowledge out there in empty space that we are part of, that we can tap into at any moment.
Wonderful. I mean, that gives us hope, certainly, in so many ways, because if we're just counting on the seen world, then we're not going to survive these times. But the unseen world is where it's happening. Apparently, we're connected to each other.
Well, absolutely. You asked me about this whole idea of non-locality. I like to say that it's a bit like separated at birth, and that's when you've got these twins that have, you know, that have been together, of course, is in the womb, and they're separated once they're born. But even though they've moved to, say, two different continents, and you've got one in New York and one in London, they'll always know about and affect each other. So let's say, even though they never meet each other again, they both love the color blue. They both end up marrying a woman called Jane, and if one goes skiing in the Alps and breaks his leg, The one in New York is going to break his leg at the exact same moment, even though he's sitting there in Starbucks drinking a cup of coffee. So it's that kind of instantaneous connection happening at every moment that goes on. That is what we understand goes on in the subatomic world. But the interesting thing is we are now finding evidence to show that that kind of instant connection occurs among big things, the big building blocks of matter, like atoms and molecules. And that is a whole different ballgame now, because it's starting to say that there are these instant connections in big things, too, in the very sticks and stones world of our lives.
So, is that the entangled particles theory? Is that what you're talking
about?
Yeah,
that's entanglement. That's another nice word for non-locality.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not just happening on the subatomic level; it's really happening on the large level.
Absolutely. Well, we're now beginning to understand that what we thought of as just something that occurred in the world of the small is now being demonstrated to occur in the world of the large too. And so that we thought there were two kinds of science, the science of the small, the science of the large, but we now realize that it's one science of life.
Is that the quantum world when we take into all levels, or what is the quantum world?
Well, the quantum world is the world of the very, very small, which is the subatomic particle, you know, the very smallest building blocks of matter. Scientists always believed that that was one kind of science, that we had the science of the very small things.
Mm-hmm.
But that once you got to big things that you could see, or the big building blocks of life, like molecules, that they would behave according to different laws that were invented by Isaac Newton, who was a great genius. But he more or less described a very well-behaved world of separate objects operating according to fixed laws in time and space. Very well-behaved universe. And they then, the scientists then in the early part of the 20th century, began peering closer and closer into tiny bits of matter, and they suddenly recognized that this stuff was a weird anarchic thing that was operating according to Alice in Wonderland properties. Not this nice rule book as had been described by Newton. In this case, these subatomic particles weren't even a set anything. They were a kind of potential of something. And that's the other thing that's mind-boggling about the subatomic world, is that subatomic particles aren't a little billiard ball as is usually depicted in physics classes. They're a little blot. They're kind of a blur of energy, and they're a potential of a self. They're not only a potential of a self, they're all possible selves, all at the same moment. So it's like describing your house as every house on the block. And so it's a very bizarre concept. But even more bizarrely is new evidence showing that not set quite gelled something, this unset jello of a thing, it actually occurs in the world at large, too, again, with giant molecules. So the message here, the big implications of this, are that the big things that we see in the world may not be finished either. They may only be a potential of something that we can affect. They may be mutable, influenceable.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So I know you talk about on the subatomic level that there's an observer effect.
Yes.
You want to describe what you mean by that?
Well, when when these physicists began to look at subatomic material and realize that it wasn't a set something, they noticed that there was one thing that changed that potential into something real, and that was when a scientist actually observed it or took a measurement. And so from there, many scientists began to theorize that there was such a thing called the observer effect, which meant that observation, our presence, our consciousness, our looking at something, our attention, is intrinsic to making the potential of something, something real. And once again, we've had this division from the science of the large and the science of the small. Up until recently, scientists have believed that this only occurs in the subatomic world, that we only have this kind of magical effect with subatomic things. But now there is new evidence demonstrating that there is this kind of what they call indeterminacy, you know, this idea that a subatomic thing isn't a set something, also occurs in big things like molecules. So that big quantum weirdness is occurring in the world that we know, the world that was supposed to be very well behaved. So they're starting to wonder whether there is such a thing as the observer effect in the world at large, too, and that there aren't two scientists, there aren't two sciences, but there's only one science, and that's quantum physics. That is the science of life.
I love it. I mean, they're coming together, and we're starting to see how we can affect on a higher, on a bigger scale, and we can heal. And you do talk about, well, you talk about Cleve Baxter's experiments, and he's an incredible researcher who of course, has done lots of work with lie detectors and so forth, and I'm fascinated by his work. You want to explain what he was able to find? What really was the most important thing that you gained from those studies?
Well, Cleve Baxter is very interesting because he was doing his work in the 60s. So this wasn't yesterday. This was quite a long time ago. Baxter is the country's greatest lie detector expert. And back in the 60s, he was a little bored one night. So he decided to take one of his pieces of polygraph equipment and hook up a plant. I just wanted to see what would happen when he poured water into that plant and, you know, whether the plant would respond. So he did, and the plant acted like it was bored. So he thought, I'm going to have to do something more drastic to it. Now, remember, polygraph equipment in the 60s was no more than a set of electrodes that you would attach to somebody's fingers, and they would be attached in turn to a readout mechanism that would describe a line with a pen, you know, and it would usually be a little squiggly line if you were telling the truth. But once you started lying, you know, it would start creating this giant squiggly line. So he was looking at this plant. The plant was describing a tiny little squiggly line that the readout mechanism wasn't doing much. So he said, I'm going to do something drastic. So maybe I should burn its leaf. And he didn't actually do the burning. He just thought about it. He just had that thought. And at the moment he had the thought, the plant's readout mechanism started going crazy. So he thought to himself, what was that? And he began thinking about it some more, and he ran in and he got a match and he lit the match and acted to all intents and purposes like he was going to burn this leaf, and the plant was still going crazy. And then he stopped, and so did the readout mechanism. It calmed down. So he began thinking to himself, what did I just witness? What on earth went on here? So he started creating a bunch of experiments that would test what he calls primary perception. And he has attached and done studies with all kinds of living things, large and small, from bacteria and sperm to yogurt and eggs. And they demonstrated that all living things have an awareness of their environment and seem to be able to not only read thoughts, but register happenings like deaths in their environment. He created an experiment, an automated experiment, that would invert a pot of brine shrimp into some boiling water. And when he did, when the shrimp would hit the water, the plants would respond with alarm, like they picked up some sort of disturbance, you know, as Yoda says, a disturbance in the force. So there was that kind of demonstration of a primary awareness, a primary consciousness of all living things, even bacteria. But because Baxter wasn't a scientist, he got ridiculed for his efforts. You asked me, what did I think of his work and why it was so important? I think Baxter was so much prefigured the whole idea that living things are beaming out and picking up information from their environment. And what ended up occurring is years after Baxter made his discoveries, his work was validated by people like Fritz Albert Popp and Dr. Gary Schwartz, who have demonstrated with a variety of equipment that living things are sending out a tiny current of light all the time. And not only are they sending this information out, but it's also being picked up and replied to. So living things are beaming out and sending and receiving it every moment.
Wow. So we really do shine our light, huh?
We shine our light, absolutely. And we pick up everybody else's light.
Wow.
Now, that has vast implications when you think about intention, because people think about intention as, you know, your Sunday best. They think that you send out intentions like going to church, you know, that all the venial, horrible thoughts are just locked up in your head, and all of the nobler thoughts and larger intentions are the things that get shot out like a very well-directed arrow. And that's not really true, I don't think. I think if we're beaming all the time, then all of the junk that's running through our heads, all of the ignoble thoughts that we have are also being beamed out, too.
Well, it's interesting that it's so timely. Your information and also Eckhart Tolle's classes, I don't know how much you're aware about Oprah.
I am aware, and I've read his book. So he's wonderful.
And he speaks to thoughts, too, and how they really are things, and that we've got to watch out for what we're thinking.
Absolutely.
Because it does do some, it really affects us, in other words. And I find this information so fascinating. In fact, I'm so interested that I put an intention experiment on my website.
Oh, wonderful.
Certainly, it's more a survey kind of experiment rather than you're doing some fantastic work. Now, I'm just going to give out my website and tell people to go and check out what I'm doing at heartlinkinstitute.com and do join in on the experiment of divine consciousness. I'm going to now ask you to tell us what experiments you've been doing and how do they get on to your website.
Well, we have been running intention experiments for the last year, and it's been very exciting because we didn't know what was going to happen. As I say, we wanted to test just to see if we could have an effect when lots of minds thought the same thing at the same time. So when I first approached Dr. Gary Schwartz, and he very generously said we can do some experiments together, I said to him, hey, let's do some intention experiments. And when I thought about this, I thought of, you know, big philanthropic projects like curing people of cancer. And Gary turned to me and said, great, let's send intention and see if we can change some of those light emissions of a leaf. And I was really, really deflated when he said this because, you know, as I say, I had in mind, you know, rescuing people from burning buildings. Mm-hmm. So, but then he convinced me that we had to show that we could have an effect, any effect. And if we were going to do this, we had to start small.
It has to be measured.
Quoting that movie Contact with the character Jodie Foster, mm-hmm. who is the scientist who wants to jump into wormholes, and the other scientists turn to her and say, baby steps, Ellie, baby steps. And that's exactly what Gary said to me. So with our first experiment, which we decided to run not on the internet yet, but just at a conference I was having in London, we decided to engage the audience in our first intention experiment. So we had two leaves, not one, two geranium leaves, and we had webcam images of them. Because they were sitting back in the University of Arizona. That's in Tucson, Arizona. So it was thousands of miles away from where we were in London. And I asked the audience to send intention to increase the light of one of them. And importantly, the scientists did not know which one it was. We were only going to tell them after they did their calculations. So we did. And our instructions were to send intentions to make the leaf glow and glow. And the reason we were so excited to work with Gary is that he has special CCD cameras which can actually photograph this living light and show it in exquisite detail. These cameras are used to photograph very faint light in outer space. And so we did this, and Gary didn't know which ones we were sending intention to. After we finished, he put both leaves in the camera one by one. And only after it was done and they'd done their calculations where they counted photon by photon, this little light, current of light, did I unblind the study. I told him which one we'd sent intention to. He calls me back a few days later. He says, you won't believe this. The leaf sent intention is glowing so much that the other leaf looks like it has a neglect effect in comparison. It was unbelievable.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic. So we were really encouraged by this. So we rolled this out on the internet. Now, the first time we ran the experiment, we were victims of our own success in that something like 10,000 people tried to get on all at the same moment, and the website crashed. So we went back and got a new web team and realized that the biggest problem we had was going to be gathering or creating a technology that would allow thousands of people to come on the same web page at the same time without causing a massive cyber traffic jam. So we did this. We found a way of doing this off of our moon website and renting server space temporarily, the size of which is used normally for things like Pop Idol and American Idol, so big server power. And so we ran it that next time, and thousands of people have participated around the world, and we found we had an effect. So, and we ran that one more time in the summertime. So then we got emboldened to try something else, and we decided, let's see if we can have something, we can do something practical. Can we make a plant grow faster? Let's see if we can do that. And so Gary had some barley seeds in his office, and he said, well, let's try that. So instead of having two sets of seeds, because you always need a set of controls. This time we had four sets of seeds because we wanted to have three controls to really control for chance, you know, so there wasn't going to be any kind of weird chance finding. So I was going, and I've been traveling around the world, and every time I have a conference, I figure it's another opportunity to send an intention. So, and to do an intention experiment. So I was in Australia, and speaking before a group of 500 people, 600 people, we thought, this is great. So we again showed them an image of the all four sets of seeds. We chose one set. Scientists did not know which ones we were doing. We sent intention to the seeds to grow faster and higher than the others. And the scientists planted all four sets of seeds and measured them and saw what happened 5 days later and measured them for growth. And only then would we unblind it, once they finished their calculations. We found we had an effect. We ran it over the internet with thousands of people from countries around the world. We had an effect. I ran it in Rhinebeck, New York, in Austin, Texas, and in South Carolina. Each time, we had an effect. And we had an effect against control sets where they tried other experiments where they did. And scientists always do this, too, where they'll run an identical experiment but not have any intention sent. So they had all four sets of seeds, planted them, et cetera, but none had intention to make sure that the one where there is an intention truly is an effect. So that's creating a control of your control. Mm-hmm. And we found that in every single time of all the studies we've run, and we've run it six times now, in every single time we've had an effect. So that has pretty amazing implications. You've got a group of people sitting there in Sydney, Australia, setting intention to a bunch of seeds, 30 seeds in Tucson, Arizona, thousands of miles away, and you have an effect. We had a tiny group in a workshop of mine in Rhinebeck, New York, sending intention to seeds in Tucson, Arizona, something like 1,500 miles away. We had an effect. Only 100 people had an effect.
Mm.
But the biggest effect of all, and this was very interesting, was with our group in South Carolina. There, I was speaking for a group of experienced healers, healing touch practitioners. And in that instance, we had an effect that was twice as large as every other place. And so that suggested to us what I had, it confirmed what I have in my book, which is experience matters. Mm-hmm. And that's why one of the things I did in the intention experiment was interview many so-called intention masters to find out what common threads they had, what were the things they all did, and to report on that. And so that's what, you know, that's what I think is a really important aspect of all of this. Experience counts. Mm-hmm. Everybody can be an intention master with practice, with technique and practice.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I just love all those experiments. Ooh, excuse me. And you have one coming up, don't you?
We do. We also ran some preliminary water experiments with Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, who is in Russia. He's in St. Petersburg. He also has equipment that can measure light emissions. So it's very, very subtle things. And we ran two water experiments showing, in the first instance, when we just sent love to the water, we changed its light emissions, because water has light emissions as well. Then we tried sending intention to actually change the light emissions, again, to make it glow, and we had a big effect. So I've moved on to another lab at Pennsylvania State University with Dr. Rustam Roy, who is arguably one of the most prestigious water labs in the country, in the world, I should say. He is a professor of material science, and his material science lab is hugely respected among the orthodoxy in science. So he's agreed to do a very interesting series of intention experiments with water. First, we want to try to change the cluster structure of water. Now, water is a very interesting property because it creates its little H2O molecules, you know, hydrogen and two hydrogens and one oxygen, create little clusters together, those molecules, almost like, think of it as bricks being arranged in certain rooms of your house. Those are the clusters, and they can change. They're fairly stable, but they can change, and certain things do change them, including electromagnetic energy. So we're looking to see whether or not intention can change it, too. And we might, you know, we don't know if it will. If it can, we're looking at whether or not it can change it to create what is often the case in healing waters at spas. There seems to be a different cluster structure. So if we can do that, imagine, water is necessary to life. It's life is made of water. We're 80% water. Plants are nearly 100% water. If we can change water, think of what we can do for healing.
Mm.
So that's the first one we're doing on April 26th. It's at 5 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, which is noontime East Coast time in America. And, it would be 1 p.m. East Coast time in America. It's 6 p.m. in English time, and it's 5 hours early there. And we'll have all of the times on our website. But it's, once again, one where everybody comes together and sends intention to that sample of water at the same time.
Wonderful. And how do they people join up for that?
They come on our website, which is www.theintentionexperiment.com, and just join. It'll tell them, join, register now for our intention experiment. People need to register ahead of time because they get some instructions of what to do and how to do it, and includes instructions about how to power up, which is how to use certain techniques to focus your mind and to focus your heart and other things that are used by intention masters.
So theintentionexperiment.com, people, if you want to join up for that, and Tell us more about the techniques, powering up, and I remember you talking about the Buddhist monks who reached a peak attention where not only had they, well, they had reached gamma wave brainwave.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I mean, the common belief is that you send intention by getting into a relaxed state and that your brain slows down. But actually, what we're finding is that in studies of Buddhist monks and other people who send intention to affect something and can do feats of intention, and monks can change their body temperature by, you know, 18 degrees and do all kinds of incredible things, they find that when they measure brainwaves, that their brainwaves don't slow down. They actually speed up to something far faster than ordinary waking consciousness. It's a bit like entering hyperspace. And I say that it is, I call the whole program powering up because that's exactly what they're doing. They're getting to a relaxed state initially with something like meditation, but then have a huge and powerful degree of focus where they're truly focusing with every pore of their bodies.
Wow. Wow. That's obviously after years of meditating. Although I do think we can train our brains pretty quickly. You go into some fascinating information about the brain and how the brain is flexible and it can be trained.
And it changes. It's very plastic. It changes according to what thoughts you have. I mean, there's very interesting studies of meditation showing that in just 3 weeks, the whole structure of your brain changes with meditation.
Mm. Wow.
And it increases the happiness portion of your brain over time. But also it increases the intuitive pathways of your brain from information that's picked up intuitively and information that's picked up cognitively, you know, through your five senses. So the brain changes. We always used to think that, you know, the brain was the thing that created the thoughts, but we're finding that in a sense the thoughts create the brain.
Mm. Wow.
And that the brain, that goes along with the views that many, many radical scientists have, that the brain is not the repository of these thoughts. It's only a receiver. And I go along with this because I'm very interested in, I collect coma stories because, and near-death experience stories, because over and over they describe a situation where the brain is flatlining and there's no blood activity to the brain, and yet the person is totally conscious and afterward records everything that went on when they were supposedly dead or unconscious.
Wow. So, and you speak about having, again, setting the stage and being in the mood and being in the right place and doing mental rehearsal. And so when we choose to do an intention, you know, to heal someone else, we should be in a good place ourselves, in other words.
Well, that was some interesting evidence that I found with Dr. Gary Schwartz's work. He found that sometimes healers had a good effect, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes their little aim was a little bit off. And so he wanted to see what was different about those days when they weren't working so well. So he gave them a number of tests and found that on days where they weren't so effective, there were days when they were not so healthy and well in every way. So he found that the best thing, the most important thing, is for them to be in a good state. So in a sense, the healer needs to be healed himself. So we found that when, you know, there have been some other studies of prayer showing that it didn't work ordinarily with just prayers praying for someone. These are, you know, there's a lot of discussion about these studies and a lot of criticism one could make about them. But one very interesting thing happened. They worked when the prayers were themselves prayed for. And the healers were healed, they were able to be effective.
Oh, wow.
So that suggests that you send, you know, you can't always do this, but when you can, you send your intention when you are healthy and well in every way. Of course, that doesn't work if your intention is to get better, of course. But it will, you know, this will, if you're just ordinarily carrying out your intention, wait for times in the day when you feel really at your best.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this is interesting in that we humans are both receivers and transmitters of information and intent.
Yes.
And we're
beaming out at every moment. That's the thing that's so interesting.
It really is fascinating. What's the optimum that you're looking for healing? Isn't the client, the patient also, is it important for that person to be tuned in, or do they have to do something as well, or is it just the transmitter that matters?
No, the tuner inner is important too. I think belief is one thing that's really important. It's important to believe. It's not the case that you can't ever have an effect on somebody when they don't necessarily believe, if you're sending intentions, say, to heal someone. But it certainly helps, and it works much better. There have been studies showing that when there is this congruence of belief between sender and receiver, that the intention works better. So that's important. And I think that that knowing the person sending the intention is also important. Forming a connection is important. Hmm. Studies have shown when someone sends an intention and someone receives it, that if the people know each other and have developed some sort of bond, it's really important.
Hmm. Wow. And so certainly if they connect and really do complement or have something in common in some way, that
yes.
really makes a difference.
Yes, absolutely.
excuse me, again, it's, for me, it's the mornings.
I know, early day, early in the day.
That's why I do an afternoon show. Interesting that you talked about how we can send or transmit an intention. I'm doing the experiment where it's all up to you to change yourself with an intention, which is obviously a little bit different from sending
sure.
to someone else. But you do talk about sending to someone else. Plus, you also talk about athletes who help themselves through mental rehearsal. I found that very
fascinating. Yes. I think this is really interesting because I was trying to find where intention is used in real life and how we can learn how to use it, because that's my interest, and it's my work. At the moment, I'm doing a lot of workshops with people where I'm showing them how to use intention in their lives, how to live with intention, and bring it into every aspect of their lives. So in looking around how intention was routinely used, I found that athletes do this all the time. They are using intention at every moment as a kind of mental rehearsal. And the greatest practitioner of this was Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
That he was using intention in every aspect. He is an intention master, or was an intention master in the ring. If you think about it, can you come up with a better affirmation than "I am the greatest"?
I think that's great. Yeah, yeah.
But he even used those little rhyming quatrains, like "Archie Moore is sure to hit the floor at 4," was in a sense an intention in disguise, because if you look at that fight, Archie Moore did hit the floor and got knocked out on the fourth round. So Ali knew exactly what to do, and many athletes now use that. They run through everything with exquisite detail in their heads as though they're carrying it out. So it's not like they're watching themselves as a video. It's like they're mentally rehearsing it and the carrying out, so they're engaged in the process of it and feeling like they're right there in the rink or, at the pitch or whatever,
mm-hmm.
just about to do their game.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I train athletes, actually. I'm a sports hypnotherapist as well as, other things like stop smoking, that thing. But we really do set the visualization for the athlete, and it works. It's incredible because they're literally going through, the body doesn't know the difference. when you're doing it in a mental rehearsal way, the body thinks it's really happening.
Well, exactly. That's the interesting thing. The brain can't distinguish between a thought and action. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful example of that with a fabulous study just of lay people trying to figure out whether or not there's any difference between thinking about going to the gym and actually going to the gym. You know, and this is a great comfort to all of us who struggle when we go to the gym. In this study, they divided the group in half, and they sent half to the gym every day to work on their biceps, and the other half were just to stay at home and in their armchairs and think about going to the gym and working on their biceps. And they found that the people going to the gym increased their bicep size by 30%, but the people who just sat home and thought about going to the gym increased their bicep size by 15%. So this is, you know, you can go home tonight, and if you don't feel like going to the gym, you can go sit in your armchair and think about it, and it'll work half as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And you speak about retro-intention, which I just wanted to also kind of briefly, we only have a short time left.
Sure.
I'm trying to cover as much area as possible for people.
Of course.
Well, tell us.
Retro-intention is really interesting because it just throws everything that we understand about time and space out the window. There have been many studies showing that you can send an intention for something that has supposedly already occurred. Now, there was a wonderful study relating to this done by an Israeli professor who wanted to try to prove that alternative medicine doesn't work. So he took a group of very ill patients with blood infection, sepsis, divided them in half, and prayed for one half of them, you know, half one group. Mm-hmm. Afterward, he looked at all of their statistics and outcomes and found that the patients who were prayed for did better in every regard, got out of the hospital sooner, fewer side effects, all of those things. But the very interesting aspect of the study was just this. The patients had been in the hospital between the years 1992 and 94. The study was carried out in the year 2000, 6 to 8 years later. So what he was doing was sending intention to them after they were well out of the hospital. Now, what was going on there? And what is going on with any kind of retro intention? What seems to be happening, and there have been many, many studies like this, measuring stuff that's already happened, like measuring our effect on REG machines after they've run, when you send an intention 3 days later. And they found in every case that there's a big effect, as though you were doing it in real time. So scientists have believed, and they've even done mathematical modeling that demonstrates this, that in a sense, intentions go back to the point where something is generated. They can flow so-called backward in time to the point where something is generated. So it's not changing the past. It's changing what would have happened in the first place. It's changing the present as it unfolds. So in other words, this is kind of like a little message from the future that's affecting the present as it's unfolding. So it can only lead us to the thought, only lead us to the thought. The time as we know it, our understanding of time is just a human construct. It's just an idea. Mm-hmm. And actually, time is much more like one great big now.
The zero-point field is timeless.
Exactly, exactly. And we're tapping into it at any moment and affecting anything at any point. So that is what would be suggested.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why hypnotherapy works. As a hypnotherapist, I have to say that when I use the timeline method with people, it works. You know, we can go back into the past and change it and give the person a whole new lease on life, so to speak. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful. Oh, Lynn, this has been so amazing. I've been speaking to Lynn McTaggart, everyone, and I'm sure that you'll get onto her website, the intentionexperiment.com, and want to find out more about what she does. It's incredible. And follow up on maybe being in an experiment.
Well, great. And may I also just say that I am running my Living with Intention workshops all around America this year. I have one in Chicago just coming up in May, on May 16th and also going to be in Los Angeles this summer, Portland, Boston, and these workshops are designed to teach people how to bring intention into their lives, how to use them and become intention masters, and how to bring them into their lives. So I've got another website for this one, which is www.theintentionworkshops.com, if anyone is interested.
Theintentionworkshops.com.
That's it.
Excellent. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Lynn McTaggart, and just keep up the great work you're doing, and I'm going to have you back on the show, and we're going to find out more about what's happening in the experiments.
Thanks so much. We really look forward to everyone participating on April 26th and thereafter.
Wonderful. Plus, you can go to my website, heartlinkinstitute.com. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s HeartLink Show. And we'll be doing this, the experiment that I'm doing, again, is all about you and helping you to anchor the intent of what's been happening in the Eckhart Tolle's classes on Oprah.com. Once again, it's a little bit different than what Lynn, you've been doing. We're doing surveys. We're measuring how people advance and help to anchor that and break free from the pain body. What a wonderful idea to be free of that. And
absolutely.
So anyway, I really am so glad that we've had this opportunity, and I love your work. And again, people, tune in next time and my show, when I will have Hank Wesselman on, and he is a fascinating shaman. He does wonderful work, and we'll be discussing his book, Spirit Walker. So thank you again for listening, and a good day, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.